Okay, let's unpack this. Today's deep dive centers on a legal case, United States v. Muhammad, from the 8th Circuit in 2010. You shared some really interesting material here. And what jumped out is how this case touches on, well, both your interest in understanding legal boundaries and those moments where, you know, seemingly small details can have surprisingly big consequences in the legal world.
Absolutely. What's fascinating here is how what seems like a minor traffic infraction can really open the door to uncovering a much larger criminal enterprise. We're looking at the intersection of the Fourth Amendment, those rules governing searches and seizures, and the complexities, really, of proving a criminal conspiracy.
Right.
It really highlights how different areas of law can just collide in a single case.
Exactly. We've got excerpts outlining the case, a perplexity analysis providing a brief overview, and a standard case brief.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission to kind of pull out the crucial insights for you, particularly as someone keen on understanding the intricacies of the legal system without getting bogged down in, you know, unnecessary jargon.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, understanding a case like Muhammad is incredibly valuable for, well, anyone looking to grasp not just the black letter law, but how legal principles are actually applied in real world scenarios. You know,
yeah.
It touches on fundamental rights and the government's ability to investigate and prosecute crime. It's pretty foundational stuff.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This case revolves around a conspiracy to commit mail fraud. Connected to fraudulently obtained commercial driver's licenses.
Right, CDLs.
But the path to uncovering this conspiracy takes a detour, a significant one, through a late-night traffic stop. And that raises some key questions about the Fourth Amendment and the standard of proof needed for a conspiracy charge.
That's right. The seemingly unrelated traffic stop becomes the crucial turning point, really. It's the moment where evidence of the larger conspiracy starts to surface. It really makes you think about how everyday interactions can suddenly take on significant legal weight.
So let's get into the core of the case, this CDL conspiracy. From what we've gathered, the central idea was a scheme to sell translated CDL test answers and even bribe officials to ensure unqualified drivers would pass their tests.
Mm-hmm.
Ernest White and Osman Abdullahi appear to be the key organizers here, with Muhammad allegedly working under Abdullahi and being aware of the bribery aspect.
What's important to pinpoint here are the specific actions that constituted this alleged conspiracy. We're talking about providing those translations, which, you know, in itself isn't illegal.
Right.
But it becomes part of a criminal scheme when coupled with the bribery of the test administrator, a person named Orban May. And the sources indicate Muhammad's alleged role was in referring students to this whole operation.
Right. And this is a really crucial distinction highlighted in the materials. There wasn't actually any direct proof that Muhammad himself personally engaged in an overt illegal act, like handing over a bribe or directly selling the fraudulent test.
No.
His involvement seems to hinge on his association with Abdullahi and his alleged knowledge of the illegal activities.
Yeah.
This raises an important question about, well, the scope of conspiracy law.
Exactly. It prompts us to consider how far the legal net of conspiracy can be cast, which we'll definitely delve into more deeply later. But first, let's switch gears and examine that fateful traffic stop, because that's where the Fourth Amendment issues really come into play in this case.
Absolutely. So picture this. It's the middle of the night, 3.04 a.m. to be precise, and Trooper Frisbee pulls over Muhammad for a seemingly minor infraction, an unlit license plate.
Okay.
It sounds like a pretty routine stop at the outset.
But as the details and the sources unfold, this routine stop quickly deviates. Trooper Frisbee begins to observe several things that heightened his suspicion. The materials note Muhammad's nervousness,
mm-hmm.
which, while common during traffic stops, you know, was apparently significant enough here to raise concern. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the trooper noticed that the door panels of the car appeared to be loose, and there were inconsistencies in the account Muhammad gave the trooper.
Exactly. And the timeline here is really critical. The sources clearly state that Tripper Frisbee issued a warning ticket for the unlit license plate at 3.11 a.m.
Okay, so the initial stop's purpose is done.
Right. So at that point, the initial legal justification for the stop the broken license plate light had been resolved. In theory, Muhammad should have been free to continue on his way.
Precisely. The lawful basis for that initial seizure had concluded. Any further detention of Muhammad would need to be supported by either, you know, additional reasonable suspicion of another crime or fall within that very narrow exception of a de minimis intrusion, basically a minimal and brief delay that doesn't necessarily require its own separate justification.
Which leads us to what happened next. Trooper Frisbee, after issuing that warning at 3:11 a.m., then asked Muhammad for consent to search the vehicle.
Okay.
Muhammad asserted his rights and declined the search. It was at that point that the trooper informed Muhammad he had reasonable suspicion to conduct a canine sniff of the vehicle.
Ah, okay. And the timing continues to be paramount, right? The canine sniff didn't occur immediately after Muhammad refused the search.
No.
According to the case details, the dog arrived and the sniff took place at 3:16 a.m.
Right.
That's approximately 5 minutes after the initial traffic stop concluded with the issuance of the warning ticket.
So here's the central Fourth Amendment question for you. Did that 5 minute extension of the stop after the initial reason for the stop was resolved to conduct a canine sniff violate Muhammad's constitutional rights against unreasonable search and seizure? This really gets to the heart of what's permissible during a traffic stop.
This is where that legal concept of a de minimis intrusion becomes crucial. The court, in its analysis, really grappled with whether that 5 minute extension constituted an unreasonable seizure beyond the scope of the original lawful stop.
Mm-hmm.
They essentially had to determine if this brief delay was so significant that it required its own independent reasonable suspicion.
And the court ultimately found that this 5 minute delay did fall under that de minimis category, didn't it?
It did.
Meaning the court considered that brief extension not substantial enough to automatically require separate reasonable suspicion beyond what might have already justified the initial stop.
That's the core of the Fourth Amendment aspect of the ruling, yeah. The court reasoned that in the context of a lawful traffic stop, a 5 minute extension for a canine sniff was brief enough not to be considered a significant infringement on Muhammad's liberty that would necessitate a higher legal standard.
So what's really insightful here is how the court balances the initial justification for a stop with the subsequent brief delay.
Yeah.
I mean, even a few minutes can be critical in an investigation, but where does that line get drawn to protect against unwarranted detention?
Yeah, it's a fine line.
However, it's also really important to highlight, as our sources do,
yeah,
that the court also specifically noted that reasonable suspicion did exist in this particular case.
Right.
Even though it wasn't strictly required for that short delay under the de minimis principle.
Yeah.
The trooper's observations, things like the noticeable nervousness, the unusual state of the car's door panels, and the conflicting information Muhammad provided,
mm-hmm,
all contributed to what's legally termed reasonable suspicion, which is, you know, a lower bar than probable cause,
mm-hmm,
but still requires more than just a hunch.
Exactly. So while the court's reasoning relied on the de minimis argument to justify the brief extension, the presence of those factors contributing to reasonable suspicion provided like an additional layer of support for their conclusion that the stop was constitutionally sound.
Right.
It's that interplay between these legal concepts that's really key to understanding the court's decision here.
And this really brings us back to that fundamental tension in law, something you're often interested in. How the legal system attempts to balance the legitimate needs of law enforcement in investigating potential criminal activity with the individual's fundamental rights and protections against unwarranted government intrusion. It's a constant balancing act.
Precisely. The Fourth Amendment is all about striking that delicate balance. And cases like Muhammad provide concrete examples of how courts apply these principles in specific factual scenarios. Now, let's pivot to the conspiracy charge against Muhammad, because that involves a completely different set of interesting legal nuances under federal law.
Okay, so Muhammad was charged under 18 U.S.C. Section 371, which is the general federal statute prohibiting conspiracy. One of the main arguments he raised on appeal concerned the instructions that were given to the jury during his trial.
And his challenge specifically centered on the fact that the jury was instructed that they did not need to find proof that Muhammad himself personally committed an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Okay.
Instead, they only needed to find that he knowingly participated in an agreement to commit a crime and that any of the individuals involved in that conspiracy committed such an act.
Which on the surface might seem a little counterintuitive to someone not deeply familiar with conspiracy law.
Yeah.
You know, you might naturally assume that to be convicted of a crime, you'd have to have personally taken some illegal action. What's the justification for holding someone responsible, even if they didn't directly act?
Well, that gets to a core principle of conspiracy law under Section 371. The statute has three essential elements that the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. First, an agreement existed to commit an unlawful act. Second, the defendant knowingly and voluntarily joined that agreement. And third, at least one overt act was committed by any member of the conspiracy to further its unlawful objective.
Okay.
The law recognizes that in a joint criminal enterprise, each participant can be held responsible for the actions taken by others in furtherance of that shared illegal goal. This really underscores a key insight into how the legal system approaches organized crime. It's not just about the individuals pulling the trigger, so to speak,
right,
but about the network and the agreement that enables the crime.
So in Mohammed's case, even though there might not have been direct evidence that he personally bribed the test administrator or physically sold fraudulent test answers, his alleged role in identifying and referring students to the scheme could be viewed by the prosecution as his knowing participation in that underlying agreement to commit mail fraud.
Exactly.
And the overt acts committed by someone like Ernest White, such as actually handing over the bribe money to Orbin May, would then satisfy that third element, the overt act requirement, for the entire conspiracy, including Mohammed.
Exactly. His role in facilitating the connection between individuals seeking fraudulent licenses and the criminal enterprise providing them was sufficient under the legal theory of conspiracy to establish his knowing participation. And the actions taken by his co-conspirators to carry out the goals of that agreement then fulfill the requirement for an overt act.
Now, there was also another layer to Mohammed's challenge to the conspiracy conviction, something referred to as the variance doctrine.
Right.
Can you break down what that legal concept means in this particular context?
Certainly. The indictment, which is the formal accusation by the prosecution against Mohammed, listed specific overt acts that the government intended to prove at trial to support the conspiracy charge.
No.
However, as the trial unfolded, the evidence presented by the prosecution included some overt acts that were slightly different from the specific examples initially laid out in the indictment. Mohammed argued that this discrepancy, this variance between what was charged and what was proven, was a significant legal error and grounds for his conviction to be overturned.
So it's essentially like the prosecution said in their formal charges, we're going to prove X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But then at trial, they presented evidence of, say, X, Y, and A actions that still aim to achieve the same illegal goal.
Precisely. That's a good way to put it. The court addressed this argument by explaining that a variance between the details alleged in the indictment and the proof offered at trial is permissible under certain conditions. The key is whether this variance affects the essential elements of the offense charged and whether the defendant was unfairly prejudiced as a result of this difference.
Right.
The court essentially asks, did the defendant understand the core nature of the charges against them, and were they able to adequately prepare a defense?
And in Mohammed's case, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals determined that these conditions were met. They said the variance wasn't fatal.
Yes, the court concluded that the variance and the specific overt acts proven at trial did not fatally undermine the conviction. The core charge remained a conspiracy to commit mail fraud related to the fraudulent commercial driver's licenses.
Okay.
The specific overt acts presented were still aimed at furthering that same conspiracy. The court reasoned that Mohammed was fully aware he was defending against a charge of conspiracy to commit the specific type of fraud, and the minor differences in the specific overt acts presented didn't fundamentally alter the nature of the accusation or prevent him from mounting a defense. No prejudice, basically.
So the big takeaway here for understanding conspiracy law is that it truly does cast a wide net in terms of criminal liability. You can be held legally accountable for a criminal agreement even if you didn't personally carry out the final illegal act, as long as you knowingly joined in the plan and someone else involved in that conspiracy took some action to make it happen.
That's a critical understanding of conspiracy law. It's about the collective nature of the criminal enterprise, and your legal responsibility stems from your agreement to participate in that shared unlawful goal, coupled with the actions of the group as a whole.
So let's bring this all together for you. What does this entire case, with its, you know, seemingly routine traffic stop that led to the discovery of a broader criminal conspiracy and the nuances of proving that conspiracy in court, really teach us about the legal landscape?
From a Fourth Amendment standpoint, United States v. Mohammed provides an illustration of how even brief extensions of otherwise lawful traffic stops are generally permissible under the de minimis intrusion doctrine, particularly when the delay is truly minimal in duration, like 5 minutes here.
Right.
It also underscores the continuing relevance of reasonable suspicion as a justification for further investigation during a traffic stop, even if not strictly required for very short delays.
Yeah, they had both belts and suspenders there almost.
Yeah.
Exactly. It really highlights the constant effort by the courts to define the boundaries between law enforcement's need to investigate potential wrongdoing and an individual's constitutional right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures.
And when we look at the conspiracy aspect of the case, what's the distillation there?
Regarding conspiracy law, Muhammad reinforces that fundamental principle that you don't necessarily have to personally commit the illegal act that is the object of the conspiracy to be found guilty of the conspiracy itself. Your knowing participation in an unlawful agreement, combined with the commission of an overt act by any of your co-conspirators to further that unlawful agreement, can be sufficient for a conviction.
Got it.
Furthermore, the case provides clarity on the application of the variance doctrine, offering some flexibility to the prosecution in presenting evidence at trial, as long as the core elements of the charged offense remain the same, and the defendant is not unfairly prejudiced by any discrepancies between the indictment and the proof offered. This is a really crucial point for anyone seeking to understand the complexities of criminal liability and how the law addresses joint criminal conduct.
This case, United States v. Muhammad, really gives you a lot to think about, doesn't it? It's a fascinating example of how seemingly disparate areas of law, the Fourth Amendment governing police stops, and the intricacies of conspiracy law can intersect in a single case, often triggered by what initially appears to be a relatively minor event in the middle of the night.
Absolutely. We've seen how a traffic stop for something as simple as an unlit license plate at 3:04 in the morning can unexpectedly unravel to reveal a much larger and more complex criminal operation involving the fraudulent issuance of commercial driver's licenses. It's quite something.
And we've also explored how the legal standards for proving a conspiracy can be quite broad, focusing on the agreement to commit a crime and the actions taken by the group as a whole, rather than requiring each individual participant to personally execute the illegal act itself.
Yeah, it really emphasizes the agreement aspect. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Just something to think about.
Okay.
Consider this. With the rapid advancement and increasing use of evolving technologies, like automated license plate readers that can instantly flag vehicles for a multitude of reasons.
Right, ALPRs.
And sophisticated data analysis tools capable of identifying patterns of potentially suspicious behavior. How might these technological advancements impact future legal cases involving traffic stops and the established legal concept of reasonable suspicion?
Mm.
Could the vast amount of real-time information now potentially available to law enforcement change the way courts evaluate what constitutes a de minimis intrusion on an individual's liberty? You know, if the tech makes checks faster, does that shorten the acceptable delay? Or does more data lower the bar for suspicion itself?
That's a really compelling question to mull over as the legal landscape continues to evolve in response to these technological shifts. Definitely something to keep an eye on.